You've found the Fabric Podcast and the conversation we're calling Where There Is Hope. Does it feel like hope is easy for you personally? What about in the face of all of the big, even existential crises our society is facing? Let's take this time to cultivate a curiosity about hope and together try to see where there is hope.
So after describing constant shelling in his neighborhood, a man that I heard interviewed this morning from Ukraine was asked, "Do you think there'll ever again be peace in your village?" And he said, I hope. So good morning. We're talking about hope. I'm Melissa. And I don't know how it is for you to do all those yoga poses, but I hope the breathing helped you feel like you're here, wherever you are. We welcome you. Welcome live streamers. Hey there. Thank you, Sage. And welcome podcast listeners. I'm glad you're here with me. Thanks for showing up with me here already. We're going to be unpacking the statement, hope exists where you have it. And I think that each of us will be able to leave here today, I'm pretty confident, with something valuable with a little bit more hope. So let's get started. Last week, Greg got us going on this journey toward where there is hope. And a couple months ago, we started talking about this, and there was a lot of funny feelings as we started talking about hope. I mean, the common refrain was, this feels like a really hard time to have hope. Even the most glass half full, serotonin blessed people that I know have been complaining about the weather this last couple weeks. Like, it's bringing us down, right? Where are you, spring? And then, not to mention all the other things that we could each quickly list, things close to home, things around the world, that just make it so hard to talk about hope. Isn't that a little tone deaf at a time like this? Or is this exactly when we need to talk about it? If hope is worth having, it's got to stand up to moments like this. This is a chance for us to discover that kind of hope. That's what Greg was talking about last week as he got us started. A Buddhist writer I read called it wise hope. So this kind of hope starts, it's on the top of your Sunday paper, you can see, just a good reminder, a basic place that we're all going to start here. From last week, that hope is a choice, and it begins with honesty. So last Sunday, before the message and all of that, Maya had us gathered outside, all the setup crew people, some of you are here, and she mentioned this thing that Anne Lamott had said, how she's a writer, and she wanted hope to be everywhere she went, right? So she said, well, I decided to just bring my own everywhere I go. So that's what we're going to talk about, BYOH, okay? Bring your own hope today. I do really love the unicorn rainbow floaty thing that Chris was inspired with for this series graphic. I mean, it just helps me feel like everything's going to be fine, right? You know, we're getting close. Isn't the pandemic almost over? And the weather's changing, I think. I sure hope we can stop talking about masks and even politics, and I hope people can just start feeling better and getting along. I hope next season the Timberwolves don't give up their leads in the fourth quarter of every game. More seriously, I really hope they can figure out this climate change thing. It's starting to sound like people are figuring it out. I really hope that if we get that new dog and I do a little more helping around the house, she'll stop drinking so much. Wishful thinking is easier. So that's your first fill-in. If you want to be taking notes, the most important thing is your own thoughts on this today. So have your pen ready if that helps you think and process this stuff for yourself. Wishful thinking seems easier until it doesn't. I think we all know that the hope we're talking about isn't about putting on rose-colored glasses or thinking that just saying positive things is some kind of solution. So then we get posters like this one. Hope, a comfortable alternative to actually doing anything constructive for yourself. Yeah, ouch. Cynicism, pessimism, unhopefulness, they seem smarter, don't they? Less naive, more realistic. Come on, let's get real. So seem is a key word here. Jamil Zaki studies optimism. He's a psychologist. He gave a talk about it in 2021. I listed it on your Sunday paper. Highly recommend you watch the whole thing. But I want you to hear something that he shared. I'm going to read from the transcript, actually. This is so interesting. 70% of people think cynics are smarter than non-cynics. 85% think they would make better lie detectors. Those people are wrong. It turns out that cynics tend to perform less well than non-cynics on cognitive tests. They earn less money. They lose more often in negotiations. They're not even good at spotting bad guys. In one study, researchers conducted mock job interviews, asking half the candidates to lie and half to tell the truth. Cynics and non-cynics watched videos of these interviews and guessed who was lying. The cynics did way worse. More generally, they assumed liars are everywhere, so they can't pick out the real ones from the crowd. So cynicism might not be as smart as you think, but it's still powerful, because our stories about each other become self-fulfilling. Cynics are more likely to refuse intimacy and cooperation. They hurt others to avoid being hurt. They tend to spy on their colleagues and suspect their friends and other people, unsurprisingly react badly, sometimes acting selfishly in response. In other words, by mistreating others, cynics create the exact conditions they fear. They tell a story full of villains and end up living in it. I call this the cynicism trap, and my lab explores ways that people fall into it. So thank you for his lab, the cynicism trap. This part of the talk that kind of makes it sound like there are cynics and there are non-cynics, right? But in another spot, he talks about when people are in the cynical condition. We all find ourselves in that condition, I think. It's so easy to be pulled into that psychological quicksand. The power and the pull of cynicism, pessimism, unhopefulness is very real and strong. It isn't that it's more realistic or honest, really. The pull is in their self-confirmation. The allure is in their self-fulfillment. We might be miserable, but at least we're right. Our unhopefulness creates the world it predicts and says, see, I told you. I told you. So novelist Barbara Kingsolver unpacks pessimism, optimism, and hope in another way that I think is helpful. Talking about winter, another season that we have sometimes in Minnesota, she says the pessimist would say, it's going to be a terrible winter, we're all going to die. The optimist would say, it's not going to be that bad. The hopeful person would say, maybe someone will still be alive in February, so I'm going to put some potatoes in the root cellar just in case. Hope is a mode of resistance, a gift I can try to cultivate. I like that. Hope is a mode of resistance. Interesting. Resistance to what, I wonder? Maybe it's apathy, throwing our hands up, stuckness, denial, numbing. Maybe it's resistance to that unvirtuous and vicious circle of impossibility that our cynicism and our pessimism creates. So while imitations of hope may seem easier and rejections of it sound smarter, hope is actually what works. It is actually the thing we need to live in the world that we want to live in. I mean, whose world do you want to go through the winter with? I want to go through the winter in the world where there's some potatoes put aside just in case to be shared. I want to live in the one that hope creates. So let's start talking about that. How do we create hope? Where do we find this? Kingsolver described hope as a mode, a gift to cultivate. Some psychologists call it a cognitive technology. The Hebrew words for hope described a state of waiting or tense expectation. Greg last week reminded us it's a choice. Today I want to riff on all of them a bit, especially Kinslover's word mode. My hope is that each one of us can leave today with this phrase that we can try on and practice this week for ourselves. And it's this: hope is a mode I can practice. Hope is a mode I can practice. Yeah. And you can practice it amidst all kinds of feelings and all kinds of realities. If hope is a choice and not an emotion, this just struck me. You know what that means? What's the opposite of hope? I don't know. I actually don't know. I can't figure it out. But it's not despair. It's not despair. I think I thought it was. But this means that you can feel unhopeful, you can feel hopeless, you can feel grief, you can even feel despair, and you can still find a way to practice hope. I'm not saying it's easy, but that it's possible feels freeing to me. It feels spacious. If hope can exist amidst all these kinds of emotions that we have in our lives and all the experiences and realities and circumstances, that means that we can practice it at any time. We can practice it today. It doesn't need anything special to line up for us to have it. You can practice it in moments and even in really small ways, things that seem small. Maybe especially in things that seem small. I had a friend last week that said she found hope where someone just listened to her. Another friend sent hope in a one emoji text message. It seems small, but it didn't feel small. Someone else spread hope by finally, you know, saying yes to something that they hadn't been ready to say yes to in a while. And someone else practiced hope by saying no for the first time. Someone else spread hope right on a piece of toast when she felt like eating for the first time in a while. So hope isn't out there, something other people do. It's right here close to us in every moment. It's a gift that you and only you can create. You give it shape and reality that's unique. And you make that choice when you're ready, on your timing. I can't make it for you. You can't make it for other people. Hope is a mode you can practice. So since I want us to be like actually really practicing this week, I'd like you to say it now and to help get our brains all involved. So just say it with me once. Hope is a mode I can practice. Hope is a mode practice. All right. You sounded so excited. Let's try that with a little more hope, okay? Hope is a mode I can practice. Okay, now turn to someone that you can see and say, hope is a mode you can practice. Go. All right, so sometimes being silly can help you do hard things. So now I want you to plug your nose.
Hope is a mode. Hope is a mode I can practice, okay?
Yeah, so keep practicing in all the different voices. So this is going to mean a really different thing for each of us in this room. I don't know where you are at, how you each struggle with hope right now. Maybe some of you don't feel the struggle at all, and you're like, what's the big deal? Why the downer? But I think all of us can name a place in our lives right now where it feels a little bit hard to have hope. So just privately, you won't have to share this. I want you to think about a place that just feels tough. It feels unhopeful right now. And there's a little tiny box on this bottom of the Sunday paper, actually. Not the big one, just the little one on the bottom. I want you to represent that thing somehow in that box. Maybe it's initials. Maybe it's a symbol. Maybe you write it in tiny letters. Maybe you write it on letters over each other. Like, no one has to be able to read this or understand it except you. So we're going to hold those hard things with us. Just set it there aside while we finish up. I want to tell you a story from a guy named Matthew. He had some experiences that showed him something about himself and something about hope. So he wrote this story about it because it meant something to him, and we have inherited this story some 2,000 years later. It's been passed down, it's been repeated, retold. And it was about Jesus and how he was prepared to be who he was, to be Jesus in the world. He was in this place called the Wild in the wilderness, and he had fasted for 40 days. And 40 is a pretty big number in a lot of the big stories. 40 means something is going to change. Something is going to need to die here in order for something new to be born. So it's good to keep in mind as you think of this story that Jesus was, they point out in this and make a point of saying he was famished. So he is feeling human, very, very human. And that's when the accuser showed up. I think we might all kind of know the accuser. The accuser showed up and started tempting him in three different ways. And the first one was to use his power to turn some stones into bread. Turn some stones into bread. He hadn't eaten for 40 days, and there would have been enough to share with everyone else, too. How satisfying and right that would feel in the moment. We want to know we are provided for and can provide for others. So then he resisted that. I won't go into what he said, but he said, it is written. And he repeated some words that he remembered. Then the second temptation came. It was to be invulnerable, to be able to jump from the tallest building and prove that the angels would catch him every time, the chance to know with certainty that he would be okay. I want to know that I'm going to be okay. I want to know that my kids are going to be okay. And Jesus resisted that temptation too. It is written. The third temptation was to have power over all the known kingdoms, all the world. He would never have to feel powerless. He would never have to watch someone he loved struggle and not be able to do anything. I want that. How very human it is to be tempted by any promises of comfort, of being able to provide comfort, of invulnerability, of any semblance of control. Want, vulnerability, and powerlessness, those seem like great things to avoid. I think it's built into our bones to want to avoid those things. So what is this story saying? Is it maybe that the meaning and the purpose and the belonging that we seek aren't found by escaping discomfort, womp, by escaping vulnerability or powerlessness, but in walking into the truth of human life and relationships, the messy one? For Jesus to have accepted the temptations would have said that we can live without needing hope, or frankly, without needing anyone or anything else. He could have chosen to have power over all things, but instead, he chose to get in there, and he chose power with all things. He said that's where the real power is. He was trusting that. Jesus chose to trust the life woven deeply that we talk about. Jesus chose to trust the fabric. That's a place of hope. Choosing that path through the messiness of life and significant relationships might be hard and painful. It is often. But it's also right, and it's full of promise. Hope only exists right in the midst of what is hard, what is far off, what feels easy to miss, what feels improbable. That's where we find hope. It's not a reason to not have it. If we want to be a parent that doesn't ever mess up, the best way to do that is to not ever be a parent, right? The safest way would be just to refuse that altogether. But I'm trying anyway to not mess up too much. There's plenty of struggle. The fact that there are struggles doesn't mean there's no hope. That's exactly where the hope grows. Brené Brown says that hope is actually a function of struggle. That has big ramifications for us, doesn't it? I mean, as a parent, we try to protect our kids from struggling, and they're losing their chance to build those habits of hope. We have to watch each other. We have to watch the people we love struggle. That's hard. That is why we practice together. Because it's so normal to, when we're trying to practice hope, we're trying to be these people of life woven deeply, to feel very unhopeless while we do it. And so we need some tricks. So that's what I want to finish up with here, are some practices, some hacks that can help us cultivate and sustain hope, even when it's hard. So these hacks are inspired by lots of sources, but they're clarified really well in a podcast with Kelly Corrigan, which is also down here. It's really short, like 15 minutes. I would listen to it if I were you. But I also see these tricks in Jesus' story and in all the stories of hope that people share with me. I think they'll make sense to you. And I'm going to buzz through the first two pretty fast. I'm going to land on the third one. They all involve being a little more choosy, let me say. And frankly, I've kind of found myself resisting this hope is a choice language. Maybe I'm not alone. It kind of makes me wonder, if I can't find hope, then is it my fault? Like, then what's the hope? Am I just on my own? I'm learning that there's usually some juice there in those resistance places where I feel kind of squirmy. When I'm willing to look at them and have some curiosity and some honesty. So I've been embracing this word choice, this idea that hope is a choice. And I think you start seeing that there are a lot of things worth being choosy about. So the three I'm going to talk about are all-out game changers. You've heard them before, you know them. And if you're like me, you need to hear them again with some new clothes on. So the first one is to be choosy about who is on your bus. We talk about the bus in quite a few ways around here. Actually, maybe you haven't heard it much, so I want to tell you now. Be choosy about who's on your bus. Zaki, the psychologist in the TED Talk, he said that his research has made him believe strongly that our social worlds, our community, shape us like clay into hopeful or cynical versions of ourselves. So who you've traveled with, the good, the bad, and the otherwise, that has shaped you, and you can't change that. But recognizing it and then getting choosy about who you will have on your bus to travel with going forward, that can make all the difference. Travel with people who are practicing hope. And know that that hope bus, this hope bus, it's full of all kinds of people that you need, not just the ones you want. I mean, look around. You've already practiced this today by choosing to be here, by choosing to watch the live stream, by choosing to listen to this podcast. So thank you for practicing with me, with us. So choose who's on your bus. There's much more to all of these, but we're going to move on to the next one that wonders, how can you be more choosy about what you spend your imagination on? So I think some people, including me, especially late at night, are really good at imagining the worst, terribilizing or villainizing in great, great detail. Remember the cynic who told stories about villains and created this world full of them? Our stories about ourselves that we rehearse in our minds and about each other, they have power to fulfill themselves. So it's really important to pay attention to this asset that we have. It can get us in trouble, but it's also this huge power. So how can we flip our really good imaginations, and when you find yourself spending 10 minutes villainizing or terribilizing, catastrophizing, notice it and say, okay, now I'm going to spend 10 minutes wonderfulizing. What if I use my imagination to imagine all the good things that could be possible? Work out some scenarios that you actually would like to see. What are the ripple effects that could have? Write it down. Make a mosaic. Do something creative. Tell someone about it. So that's the second one. We're going to go on to this third one that I want to land on a little bit longer. And before I get there, I want you to make another note on your Sunday paper. So this time I want you to think about a positive change that you have experienced ever. Like, there was a time when my kids could not eat with a spoon, and now they can. Okay? So any kind of change you've experienced ever, or what's a positive change you've witnessed? So think of either one of those, and or one or more, write them down on your Sunday paper. There's a bigger box for you to do that. So practice remembering some change that you have witnessed or experienced, and write it down. All right, thanks for pondering that, stories of positive change. Because I think we all are pretty darn immersed in the stories of human depravity, of what's wrong, in the stories that make us compare ourselves and measure up. Elliot, do you have a slide with like my news recommended stories just for me on my computer the other day? Ooh, yeah, they look hopeful. Uh-huh, yeah, those were just for me. I mean, honestly, that's what sells, right? You create, you know, play on this human, very baked-in human capacity to look at for all the threats, right? We're looking for the threats, and this just builds on that and stirs it up in us, and then for sure offers something that will make us feel better, some kind of cheap shortcut. To be crass, like, this is just what sells. We inflate this kernel of truth about the threats that we live in and then sell solutions to relieve it. It's really quite a racket, and this is all around us, and we're probably part of it. And it's not that we should ignore the kernels of truth of suffering in the world. There is a lot of hard stuff going on. There's a lot of brokenness, and this is exactly why we need hope. Hope clearly does not call us to deny, ignore, or permanently numb ourselves from those hard things. But when we only let those sink in, that affects us, and it's not actually reflecting reality. So we need to start being a little more choosy about what we invite to sink in. There's plenty of things that just are around us that will possibly sink in. We can deal with that. But we need to be choosy about not only truly feeling the hard stuff, but also, you know what, there are stories of change. You just heard them. You just remembered some yourself. Hope begins with that honesty. If you look at Jesus' life and that is a story you find some meaning in, like I do, you can see that Jesus had a lot of hard feelings. Like, he felt grief. He wept over friends. He wept over a city that was full of people hurting and broken and disconnected. He got angry. He threw over tables where people were selling stuff, selling cheap promises. So we feel it in our guts like that too. So we have to let that sink in. It motivates us. We also need to be honest about the reality of change and of movement and of moments of joy and beauty and connection. In that earlier story, Jesus met every temptation with, "It is written." And he repeated words that he had known since he was a child, words that he had wrestled with, that he had taught, that he had been told. There were words that reminded him of this bigger vision, this provision that is there for us. Words that he had in him, he had let them sink in, and they helped him resist those temptations to give up. He internalized them when it was easier so that he'd have them there when it got hard. So practice when it's easy, right? that's what we did today, a little bit. I hope that this can help you let those things sink in that can be there for you. Because often we get taught by experience and these outer messages to believe this kind of over-personalized version, this illusion that it's all up to me, it's all my fault, or it's all about me, forgetting this larger context that we're a part of. This one that includes systemic barriers, systemic privileges that we're a part of. This one that includes inheritances of both trauma and resilience. This bigger picture of fabric that we're woven into. And honest hope calls us out of ourselves to see those larger realities that we're part of, not apart from. All of them. And it doesn't expect us to not have feelings about them. So hope is a mode you can practice. What will you invite in to sink in? What will you spend your imagination on? Who will be on your bus to remind you that tomorrow does not have to be the same as today? It won't be the same, in fact. Change is always happening, and hope will be there in that change because we bring it there.
Thanks for listening. We hope this podcast sparks conversation in other parts of your life. If you're looking for meaningful connections, there's a Fabric group for you to try, whether you're in the Twin Cities or not. Tag @FabricMPLS with your wonderings on social media and find resources on our website, fabricmpls.com.